preparations for the case.
Right.
Jim and I came back, and he was going over the documents we got on discovery, which I had copies of only some. And I started to prepare an unusual aspect of this evidentiary hearing. It was a non-lawyer's approach, and it turned out to be the ideal legal approach. How do you question the performance of a lawyer like Foreman? How do you present evidence on effectiveness of counsel? I decided to do it in terms of how he handled the evidence, and I wasn't enough of an expert on the evidence to do it. So I prepared this. I came home and I went to work right away and worked around the clock. And I had it all prepared for use in two possible ways. First, with me as an expert witness testifying. Mm-hmm. And I had documents keyed in with every bit of it. Some of these documents obtained on discovery. The documents Foreman had and didn't use. And the other was if they decided to go ahead with the hearing, then this would be the outline of it.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, Bud was going to use me as an expert witness, and then he changed his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I presume that it was something that the judge said in chambers that disclosed the prejudice that caused him to make that decision,
mm-hmm.
because I understand the judge did disclose prejudice. I don't know what the basis of that prejudice is, unless it is some of the really rotten stuff that Henry Hale pulled.
Mm-hmm.
I addressed some of it, and I think probably the judge was indignant that I would dare address it directly into him and put him on the spot because he never did anything about it.
Yeah, okay.
But
Hale
has since been fired.
Okay.
So the case was all outlined
mm-hmm.
with this concept. And there were other concepts, for example, conflict of interest, just as you saw it in the frame of this.
Yeah.
That turned out to be an enormous understatement, Esther.
Mm-hmm.
What we got on discovery, when we couldn't exercise complete discovery,
mm-hmm.
the judge was not helpful on that.
Mm-hmm.
He leaned over backwards. What we got was still enough, more than enough, for an overwhelming case of financial corruption and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
The judge just didn't want to pay attention to it. And Jim worked that stuff out. So we then were stalled a little bit more by the judge honoring an untimely request for discovery by the state, and we had to have an extra hearing on the 17th, which interfered enormously with our ability to prepare for the evidentiary hearing. We never were able to fully prepare for it.
Mm-hmm.
He kept us under fantastic pressure. I told you I began working 11:20 one night to prepare interrogations for total strangers for the lawyers. Who ever heard of trying
sure.
a lawsuit this way? Now, one of these people is an indispensable witness, and I never had a chance to interview him. I knew what his story would be.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed away from him so there'd be no pressure on him. I looked him up. We were down there on discovery, so it looked like a casual meeting. I spoke to him very briefly.
Mm-hmm.
He told me exactly what I knew
exactly,
he would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Went no farther than that. And they have still withheld from us under discovery some of the relevant proof that will confirm his story.
Mm-hmm.
But this is indispensable in proving the frame-up.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is the way we went to
so
work.
But they never came into court then? You never
oh yes, that is
did.
In court. Part
oh,
of
no.
it.
Yeah, okay.
Part of it is in court. But again, I wasn't there for it, but I know he stacked up.
Mm-hmm.
The package was dropped before the crime was committed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you like me to go into that?
I've got all kinds of things that I'd like you to go. Okay.
Well, that's why I'm trying not to direct your thinking.
Fine, okay.
I don't know if you want me to or if you want me to at this point. I really do think that in terms of your understanding,
yeah,
it would
that.
Be helpful to do it at this point.
Okay, absolutely. No, I was going to say yes. I've got other things too, but I don't want to get you off. Okay.
Well, I think that you ought to understand how the crime was committed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to tell you one thing that I think you should come back to later. Without
mm-hmm.
question, Ray was not at the scene of the crime when it was committed.
Okay, Jim has said that, and he says he's got proof of that.
I got the most fantastic alibi you ever heard of. Phil Canale will be James L. Ray's alibi, and Phil Canale was the prosecutor.
I know. Okay.
I got them separately on tape,
mm-hmm.
and neither one knew about the taping of the other. It was the very first meeting I had with Ray that I got Ray's version,
mm-hmm.
and he couldn't have given me that version except if he were in a position to know what Canale had already said.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, the whole scheme was to leave what would connect Gray with the crime. Now, it was not, I am certain, expected to hold up for very long. Its purpose was to give those who committed the crime a chance to get away, no more.
Right. Never in their wildest dreams.
That's right. The crime was committed from the parking lot between the firehouse and the pair of buildings that were the flop house. I have a witness on tape, a witness who may not today be alive. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed him with an identifiable background. Mm-hmm. The TV news in the hospital in which he was and in the presence of a witness.
Mm-hmm.
So we can date it from that.
Mm-hmm.
And he personally told Phil Canale where the crime was committed from, and he personally told me on tape that this part of what he told Canale, Canale wasn't interested in. It's Bertie Reeves, and they did use him in part of the narration. You may remember Beasley's narration.
Mm-hmm. So he was, I assume he was in the hospital very sick when you said he may not be alive.
Emphysema, and he's 75 years old. Mm-hmm. And this was in 1971, in February 1971.
And there is a television film of that.
Television what?
You said that you did that.
No, on tape.
Audio
like
tape,
this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did was to use TV news as a background to date the tape.
Oh, I see. It was on the tube.
It was on the tube, and
oh,
you
I
can
got
hear
it.
It.
Okay, fine.
I took him into the sun porch, recreation room, of this hospital,
mm-hmm.
where there was a TV set,
mm-hmm.
and there was TV news that will date the time of the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I told you earlier about the kind of people the Rays are, and this becomes indispensable in understanding mm-hmm. what really happened. Ray was told, as I remember it, at about 20 minutes after 5, that Raul, and I don't know if his name is Raul or not,
sure.
but I am certain there is such a person,
mm-hmm.
Would need the car and would have a private meeting with other people for which he didn't want Ray present, and why didn't Ray get lost for a little while,
mm-hmm.
but to leave the car. Ray went down and noticed that the right rear tire was low. And then he remembered, and this is another one of these strange quirks in the story, that the day before, a state trooper had stopped him Mississippi and said, "Hey, buddy, you got a slow leak." So Ray says, "Well, I'll fix the tire for my old pal Raul." And he gave me a description of where he went to get the tire fixed. And I had known this story before I saw Ray from another source. A man in the service station. Ray gave me a description of where he went and what happened. It
mm-hmm.
was rush hour. And the guy said, "Pal, we're a little bit busy now. This is rush hour. Why don't you just put some air in and come back in a couple hours and we'll fix your tire?" Ray says, "Okay." He goes over to the air, puts air in the tire, and he's on the street parallel with Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember I told you how Jerry drives.
Mm-hmm.
He drives a little bit past the flop house. Then he makes a right turn to come back on Main Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a block, maybe it was two blocks, past the right street.
Mm-hmm.
He makes a right turn.
Mm-hmm.
There is a bend in the street at that point. And as he comes around the bend, you can go there and you'll see it.
Okay.
And as he comes around the bend,
mm-hmm.
he sees the barricades. The crime has already been committed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ray gave me a description of the barricades. Now, how in the hell could he know what the barricades looked like and give me a description unless he saw it and was on the wrong side to see it? He couldn't have escaped it. And this was a little bit of time after the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Gives me a description of the location of the police cars, where he's uncertain and where he's certain. And it coincides perfectly with the speech that Canale made to the Jackson meeting of the bar.
I have a copy of that.
We have that tape if you want it.
I've got a copy of that transcript. Now you have Ray on tape telling you the story.
Identically what?
From inside jail.
Can you think of a better alibi?
No, if you knew what a barricade looked like, unless...
Now look, how can you say whether they used police cars or anything else to create the barricade?
No. The only thing one could speculate is that in order to have an alibi, he went around for a look.
But you're, nobody's that crazy.
I know, I was going to say, that's the only way he could speculate that he would know what the barricades were like and where they were. He came back to check just so he could have an alibi.
Yeah.
But that's not that crazy. It would be that devious and that clever. Okay.
Now, again, this is delicate stuff that I want you to pay attention to. He's telling me this story, and I said, well, continue and tell me what else you did. And I think this is a very significant thing. I can't be certain of the exact precise figure, but I think he told me he had driven about 50 miles going toward New Orleans, and then he said, and this is an accurate paraphrase, he said, and all of a sudden I realized I go there, I get killed.
Yeah, that's not New Orleans. Let me ask you one other thing. That story that was the first one appeared that Ray was telling, he was sitting in the car, Raul comes running in, sits in the car,
that was,
goes
that
out.
That was to get Huey off his back. Let me come back to that.
Fine.
And that, because this is
I just
want
to dismiss that one. I want to dismiss
this
that one.
This is a question you asked me. This gets to a question you asked me over the phone. Ray said he then turned and drove toward Atlanta. Remember you asked me because of all the questions I had in a frame-up about whether this was the real car. And he says he actually did drive the car to Atlanta.
I got to look and see the condition of the right rear tire of that car if I ever get out the car, don't I?
Well, yeah.
If they fix that
now
or
it
not.
May have been fixed. Now, what, I wanted to get that in. Sure. Now, what was it you had just asked me?
Okay, we were talking about the car. We were talking about... Well, we just finished with...
Oh, I said, let me come back to that. Let me finish this. You
right.
just asked me a question.
Okay, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
Now, Ray told me that during the course of that trip to Atlanta, he stopped and he wiped the car clean of fingerprints. He told me also that it rained. And he told me where the FBI had to find fingerprints on the car that were added after he cleaned it, because he stopped for gas. And the man who opened the gas cap had to have left fingerprints on the car.
The FBI said that the car was completely clean?
No, no. Ray told me he cleaned it. The FBI found fingerprints, but not of Ray.
Okay.
They have kept secret whose fingerprints these are. I remember some
Why
on the right front
that?
Door, huh?
Why are they doing it?
Well, they got, look, they got a bird.
No.
They
Why
got a
they
bird in hand. Why beat the bushes? They got Ray in jail.
Sure, okay.
The FBI's problem is very simple. Now, again, something has to be confidential.
Okay.
They've offered Ray a deal. Ray turned it down. Ray's explanation to me for turning, and Bud Fenstewald did not tell me this, but they offered the deal through Bud. Ray's explanation to me is I'm not going to do the FBI's work for him. However, my belief is that Ray couldn't solve their problem for them. They know better than Ray who was at the scene of the crime with Ray. They can identify them, but they got the same problem.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to connect him with the crime? Placing him at the scene of the crime doesn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You follow me?
Yeah.
So they got the same problem with Ray. The difference is they got Ray in jail.
That's really a PR problem more than anything else. They can embarrass themselves, but they haven't got the goods to get the guys who they assume really did it.
They offered to turn Ray loose in England if he would tell all, close quotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was no all he could tell.
Yeah.
But Ray's story to me, and incidentally, this is the kind of guy he is. It's quite consistent with Ray's character.
What did you say?
I'm not going to do the FBI's job for him.
Yeah.
Let them do it.
What would they do for me?
No, it's not only that. It's this America business. I would, if I were in a pinch with James Earl Ray with me, I would trust James Earl Ray. I would trust him sooner than any one of the lawyers that up to now have figured in this case on any side.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that, Esther.
Mm-hmm. No, what I stopped you before is when you were mentioning New Orleans.
Yes.
That is obviously a location that has come up in your writing, and obviously in Lomax. And do we know where Stein is?
No.
Okay.
His sister, when last I was in New Orleans, was in Algiers, but she wasn't talking to anybody. I got the rap sheet on her and the rap sheet on Stein, if you want them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how relevant that really is. But it may be.
Mm-hmm.
There may be, because after all, Stein has never been subjected to a good questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was telling you how the crime was committed.
Right.
I told you what Ray had done. Now let me get back to what the people were expecting. They were expecting Jimmy to go off to a movie, have supper and go to a movie. They were not expecting to be a good pal and get a tire fixed. They were expecting the car to be there. Everybody lied about where the car was.
Okay, hold on now just a second. There is Ray, the stuff about the Rebel Motel, was that Ray?
Yes, that's a separate story. Let me finish this and then remind you.
Okay, I'm West now. How come Ray was Willard who took that room? I want to know.
I have no doubt about that.
Okay,
I didn't
fine.
Even ask him about it.
Okay, fine. He really took that room. And then someone
said... Wait a minute. I think I did ask him about that in the first interview.
Mm-hmm.
And that he said that he did take the room, but there was no jazz about wanting one in any particular place.
Right, okay.
He just wanted a room.
A simple room that he didn't need a whole fancy.
Well, this gets back to the Rebel, but remind me to come back to the rest of the
crime.
Now, here's what really happened. Ray did not go directly to Memphis and to the new Rebel Motel.
Yeah.
He went to the DeSoto, just as he told me. Nobody ever checked it out, but the FBI did.
Mm-hmm.
I got Renfro Hayes, who was supposed to be the investigator on the
mm-hmm.
case under Haynes, to drive me there.
Mm-hmm.
And even after Hayes read the proofs of my book, he didn't even go there. I get him to drive me there, and it's a hot sheet joint.
Mm-hmm.
They have rules and laws and Mississippi, so that you can check in by saying, hi, pal, and just writing it on a card. They never look at it, and it doesn't
right.
violate the law.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there, and I found two maids. They were blowing Renfro Hayes' mind.
Mm-hmm.
I found two maids, both of whom had been interviewed by the FBI the very next day. They knew Ray was there. Ray even shifted rooms when he was there.
Mm-hmm.
So the FBI knew Ray was there and withheld this.
Mm-hmm.
It was while Ray was driving from there to the new Rebel, which is what he had been directed to do for a meeting,
mm-hmm.
that he stopped at this drugstore and picked up the stuff. I also stopped at the drugstore. Nobody working there in 1971 worked there at the time
mm-hmm.
Ray did this, but people there remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
And the people at the drugstore, of course, were also interviewed by the FBI. I mean, it's on a direct road.
Mm-hmm.
At the new Rebel Motel, Ray had a meeting with Raul. And as I remember it, and I think I'm correct on this, it is at that point that he turned the rifle over to Raul
mm-hmm.
for Raul to use allegedly as a sample.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one thing that could not have been used for was to sell to Cubans of either side. Neither one was about to pay a premium, and neither one had any need for it. The revanchist Cubans still have stashes all over the United States of American rifles. Hurricane Camille washed up some.
Mm-hmm.
If there was any legitimacy to it, and I believe it was just a cock and bull story, it could have been a sideline of the same criminals to sell untraceable weapons to the radical right of the South.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe it had any legitimacy. I think it was a cock and bull story.
Mm.
Raul was with Ray when Ray bought the rifle at Aero Marine. Raul was sitting
people?
In the car.
Oh, okay.
That's not known. See, this is,
I'm telling
you. I was
going
to say,
that's new to me. That's why I stopped. I said, oh, and he wasn't in the store. He was outside. Okay.
It was in the car, not in the store.
Okay.
This, I'm telling you, this I got from Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Where were we?
Well, we were talking about, he gave the gun.
New Rebel Motel.
New Rebel Motel gives him the gun.
At the New Rebel Motel,
mm-hmm.
Raul set up the deal for the flop house.
Mm-hmm.
He gave Ray, because I told you how Jerry drives,
mm-hmm.
he even wrote it out on a piece of paper and gave it to Jimmy so Jimmy would know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a confusion. Between two Jim's restaurants,
mm-hmm.
Jim's Bar and Jim's Place.
Mm-hmm.
Jim's Place still exists. It's been moved into the Round Towner Motel.
Mm-hmm.
And the press party after the hearing was over was in Jim's Place.
Mm-hmm.
Henry Hale and Paul Stagg and I were there. As the guests, again, we were on the motel business.
Right, and you
so Jimmy goes to the flop house,
yeah.
overshoots it a couple of blocks. The wrong Jim's is on the opposite side of Main Street, and he comes back and he checks in. And again, you see, this is the kind of thing that gets into the defense where we have to be very careful. He is then visited by Raul and another man whose description I have.
And somebody else testified to the fact that there were three people in that room early in the afternoon. I saw that in the papers. Okay, go ahead.
I don't remember that. But in any event, I do have a description.
This is at the Flophouse, though.
Yes.
Okay.
And the first thing Raul does is send him to York Arms, which was then within easy walking distance to the north. They closed up that place to buy the binoculars.
All right. Let me ask you one other thing, speaking of what's going on. The motel is still there. The Lorraine is still there as it was, and it's a shrine. Is the room
part of it is a shrine, and I got some pictures that may interest you.
Okay.
But shut up.
Is the rooming house still there as a rooming house?
Yes, I took my own pictures there. I interviewed Lloyd Jowers there, and I have it on tape. And I have a piece of the windowsill that the cops and the FBI left behind. And I still have it sealed and dated from the time I got it.
Yeah, but I'm talking also about for our production purposes, that room and that bathroom and the Lorraine are still there.
It's about to be torn down.
Okay.
Now, the state deceived Jim and me on this, which is one reason why Herb McDonald could improvise the way he did. They told us that it had been sealed. Carlisle, the chief investigator for Canali's office, told us that the building was about to be destroyed and had been sealed, but it was not sealed. We didn't find that out until later. So I couldn't take Herb McDonald down there based on what Carlisle had told me, and we were pressed for time. The Lorraine was still there, and the new rebel is there, and I can take you through all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
If you want me to,
yeah.
And go over with these people what I went over with them. And of course I have the tapes. Now there is one thing in the middle of one of my tapes that relates to a different case. And it is its own kind of a mind blower. That, of course, is a place that would have to be confidential. But it was not on the King case. It was something I happened to do when I was in Memphis in February 1971. And there are other relevant witnesses. I found them. And there's one I didn't have time to find, but I knew where he was then. I don't think we're going to need him for the trial, but there are other witnesses you could use, of whom I know.
So then Jimmy
comes back with the binoculars, for which there was no need at all. It was merely a means of placing Jimmy in Memphis. Just as there was no need for the scope on the rifle, you were better off without the scope at that range. And they were careless with the rifle, however, in other ways. And that's when they tell Jimmy that they're going to have a private meeting, they don't want him around. And of course, picking a flop house like that, which incidentally shows some knowledge of the local turf, was an ideal thing with a man like Ray for setting up such a meeting. Now, I have found another such place, and I have pictures of it. Not in Memphis, but in New Orleans. And I believe it is one of the things that could lead to a solving of crime.
Mm-hmm.
We have leads on solving the crime. And the way that worked, I'm the only one ever lean on Jimmy. I still do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give a damn. I lean on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he reacts. He trusts me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence of some of this leaning, he gave Jim a cryptic lead because there was a question of surveillance that we were able to piece together, and it coincides perfectly with these pictures I had taken 3 weeks, 3 years earlier. And Bud Fensterwall still doesn't know how I took those pictures.
Mm-hmm.
He never mentioned it to me, but he has said to Jim, how in the hell could Hal do this?
Yeah.
So we do have leads on solving the crime, although that has not been the thrust of our work.
I'm sure.
Now, this gets us again to how the crime was actually committed.
Mm-hmm.
These people expected the car to be there. Now, let me tell you about the cars. There were two white cars. There's no reason to believe the second one was a Mustang. The one near Knipes was not Ray's. I have repetitious witnesses on this.
It's the Arkansas plated white Mustang.
That Ray's car was parked in front of the real Jim's outside the flophouse. There is a hydrant there. Lloyd Jowers came in behind Ray's car and pumped and parked bumper to bumper.
To avoid the hydrant.
Without quite enough room between him and the hydrant, Loy Jowers had an unmistakable car, a white Cadillac.
Mm-hmm.
Ray's car was there, not where they said it was. And Foreman knew it. Stanton knew it. I got separate proof of it from their files in discovery. I knew it from witnesses.
Okay, let's stop for a second then. Because I'm again confused.
Yes,
what time exactly are we talking about that Ray's car was there or wasn't there? What time did he do that?
Until he left to get it fixed. The tire fixed.
Fine.
After he came back from York Arms, he parked the car.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, if you find the chart, it's the one on the, it's the one away from the parking lot. You know, we had to make three efforts to get that chart.
I believe it.
They said they sent them and didn't. They got lost in the mail. I finally had to get it through a friend in Minneapolis. They were not reaching me or the publisher, so I turned this off for a minute.
Sure.